This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Not long ago, there was a meeting in East Chicago for residents and interested residents as well as the veterans about the opportunities to be able to best coordinate the very complex and sometimes confusing Veterans Affairs healthcare system and Medicare. And we have as our guest today the person who knows the best about the Medicare system, because she was one of the presenters at that program. Araceli Corona is a Whiting Robertsdale neighborhood resident and owns a business, an insurance agency in the area. And she works very closely with veterans, especially if they are involved in the Medicare system, but only the Medicare system. And she brought into for the conversation that she had recently a retired reserve colonel in the Army. And we'll hear from him and his some comments that he has for us today about the importance of being able to best use the Medicare system and the VA healthcare system. Araceli, thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
Thank you so much for having us.
Well, since you focus primarily in your business as an insurance agent, and in this case here working on the coordination of the program together about the Medicare system, give us a brief overview about, I guess, the differences are certainly the fact that it is very complex if you're trying to take advantage of both the VA healthcare system, which is complex in its own right, and the Medicare system, which is also complex.
That is correct. And it's even more complex because there are 22 million vets and 9 million of them are enrolled in the VA. So about 13 million are not enrolled and some do not qualify, but there are approximately 60% who are not optimizing their benefits both at the VA and also with Medicare. And that's part of the reason why I'm so passionate about doing events like the one in East Chicago last week, because knowledge is power. Information is power. And many times it's important to dispel myths that there might exist or to clarify how the VA works and how Medicare works, because the reality is that they both offer unique services that can assist our population.
Now, we should mention that there was this program last week at the American Legion Post 369 in East Chicago, and there will be more like these very soon coming up. We'll talk about that before we finish our conversation today. But to let you know that veterans will have many opportunities, hopefully, to learn more about ways to best coordinate their VA health care benefits if they receive them, as well as Medicare benefits if they are receiving them now, too.
And that is correct. And I'm very blessed to be a part of a team that's called Advocate Health, which it's actually vet-owned and operated. So who better to communicate to our vets how to manage the VA system than someone like retired Colonel Cullen Wright, who came out, and he works very closely with the diverse veteran service officers and organizations, and to be able to provide insights as to how to maximize and optimize VA benefits. And on my end, my area of expertise would be how to understand the uniquenesses and intricacies of the Medicare system.
Let's turn our conversation over now to Army Reserve Colonel, retired Colonel Cullen Wright, who is with Araceli Corona at this presentation. He is focused a lot of his time and efforts concerning the VA healthcare system, and he's going to explain a number of things for us, things that you may or may not be aware of, and we want to be able to be able to pass along to you too. And you can find out more at these information sessions coming up. Here is retired Lieutenant Colonel Cullen Wright.
My journey to Advocate began in the military. Our CEO and founder was actually our brigade level commander, and I was his deputy commander. We had passed each other for probably 20 years in the branch that we held in the military, because it's a fairly small branch, but we'd never really had assignments where we worked that closely together, and it was just an instant connection. What I get to do is wonderful. We go out and we interact with our veterans in many different venues, but what we basically end up doing is two simple things. We're not with the VA, but we encourage them to use the VA. We see great value in that, and we encourage them to do that. If they're having difficulties with that process, we've got staff that has expertise, and we'll also link them up with local staff in their area that work for organizations that have veteran services officers of their own. Do you use your VA benefits? Do you know the different ways to use your Medicare? And do you know how to use those two together? If there's a no in there anywhere, the Advocate Veterans Initiative can most likely help you.
That was a retired Army Colonel Cullen Wright, who's very passionate about helping veterans. He's a veterans officer himself here in Northwest Indiana and in the region, to explain to people the importance if you have the Veterans Affairs health care benefits, to be able to best use them with Medicare. And with us here to talk about the Medicare side, we have Araceli Corona. Now, with these presentations, it's probably, as we've started our conversation, difficult to understand how you could coordinate two very different, very complex and confusing systems, but it can be done, I understand.
Yes, it can be done. And what a lot of our vets don't realize is that they do qualify for a special election period through the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid. Most people don't realize that Medicare is actually the United States government's program for health care. And in most cases, you have to work 10 years to qualify for Part A, which covers hospital stays, or to be married to someone who has worked over 10 years. And then there is Part B, which covers doctor care. And there generally is a monthly premium that is adjusted to that most are not aware of. But the interesting thing that's unique to veterans is that they do qualify for that special election period to be able to enroll in either a Medicare supplement, a Medicare Advantage, or a prescription drug plan. Because the reality is, a VA script only works for the VA, and a private doctor script only works in the private system.
Mm-hmm. And I imagine, too, that depending on the individual veteran who is able to get his meds with VA, or for that matter, an individual who is not a veteran that gets meds through the Medicare system, they may have maybe an opportunity to be able, because of a special condition they may have, aside from, we'll say, diabetes, because you can, the diabetic can get medications and services through either VA or Medicare. And there's maybe a case where there might be a special case or special condition that somebody may have, that they may have to rely, for example, more on Medicare than on VA?
That is correct, because VA is the expert when it comes to anything pertaining to veterans and injuries and anything pertaining to war matters. Medicare, on the other hand, allows access to private health care systems. And depending on whether you're looking at a Medicare supplement or an Advantage plan, there are different networks and opportunities for people to seek care, both here in Northwest Indiana or even beyond.
I know lately the Veterans Affairs Department has been sending out letters to individual veterans, letting them know about some changes that the VA healthcare system has been making and trying to make in the future. They have some plans that they would like to put into place. And one of those in particular might be of interest, especially for veterans that are perhaps in the need, or anybody for that matter, that has to go to an urgent care center for some emergency, although not dire emergency, but some emergency care. And the VA is trying to make it easier for veterans to be able to take advantage of these privately owned and operated urgent care services. Is this something that you've been aware of, that you've learned in what you've studied about this? Although it's a VA program, it's something that we know that the folks that handle cases and the clients through Medicare are probably very interested in.
Yes, and we always want to encourage vets to utilize the resources of the VA, and we also want to make them aware that through Medicare, they do have other options to access those urgent care clinics, because in many cases, if you have a cold, if you have a flu, it doesn't necessarily make sense to go to the VA to seek care for that. Mm-hmm. So we live in very interesting times where, as you know, healthcare is creatively being reformed and modified because people's needs are changing. And it's really important to know what information is out there and what resources are out there specific to Medicare and specific to the VA.
Now, we mentioned at the start of our conversation about the opportunity to find out more information about ways to coordinate the VA healthcare system as well as the Medicare system with more public conversations. Tell us about the next ones coming up here, similar to the one that you and Colonel Wright had not long ago.
So the wonderful thing about the event that we went to in East Chicago is we were able to connect with a lot of veteran service officers and intergovernmental agencies, and we're putting together a schedule of events unique to Northwest Indiana, where we have been invited to come out and present educational events to be able to explain the priority classifications at the VA, the DD forms that the veterans need to sign, as well as the requirements to be able to complete qualification for original Medicare and to explore the Medicare supplement, the Medicare Advantage, and the prescription drug programs. Okay. So that will be forthcoming on our websites. So www.advocateforveterans.com is one of the websites that I will refer people to, or to call me at 773-968-6649 or 219-801-1276, because we're trying to target Lake and Porter counties. And scheduling purposes, we're very grassroots. We want to go out and meet as many people as we can to encourage them to optimize their benefits, both with the VA and with Medicare, because many are not aware of even some of the programs that are out there on the Medicare side that can impact their quality of life also.
In the last presentation that you had at the American Legion Post in East Chicago, did you come up with a good audience? Did you come up with a lot of questions and people that are very interested in how this this coordination can take place?
Yes, we did, actually. There were a lot of people who were not aware that they could qualify for VA mm-hmm. benefits, specifically, in some cases, spouses. And we did find a number of people who were not aware of the various options that exist even within Medicare to be able to access doctors that are not necessarily with the VA system.
Well, we'll have more information. You can check the websites, as Araceli has mentioned here, to find out when the next series of public conversations will be coming up here in Northwest Indiana for veterans that are interested in optimizing the best of their VA health care services that they get or maybe are eligible for getting, as well as the Medicare that they may already be receiving or are also maybe eligible to receive as well in the future. Araceli Corona is a Northwest Indiana insurance agent, and she's been working very closely with veterans and other groups and helping coordinate the efforts of the VA healthcare system, which she's not the specialist in, but she is in Medicare. And we thank you very much for spending time to talk with us today.
Thank you so much for the invite. And on behalf of retired Colonel Colin Wright, we also thank you so much for allowing us the opportunity to spread the word, because it's so important to reach our veterans, because our veteran community did so much for us. The least we can do as a system, especially when it comes to something as special as our health care.
This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. The U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs has in place new disability appeals procedures, one of the most significant changes in decades that affect the VA and the veterans that it serves. Cheryl Mason is the chairperson for the VA's Board of Veterans Appeals. She came on Regionally Speaking to talk about the changes, why they were made, and the changes' impact on veterans everywhere.
First of all, we saw an increase of 350% in our appeals. And it was a broken system. It was complex and it was confusing to our veterans. And they were waiting too long. They were waiting 3 to 7 years on average, and that's just not acceptable. So in an unprecedented action, the VA brought in our stakeholders, our veterans representatives and advocates, and Hill staff, and we all collaborated and worked together to fix this. And out of that came the Appeals Modernization Act. And that is what we're implementing a week from today, February 19th, 2019. We have continued that collaboration going forward. It is built to give veterans choice and control, to give them quicker resolution, and to provide clearer communications so they know what they need to provide to us to be successful in their cases.
Now, before we get into talking a little bit more about, I suppose, the nuts and bolts of what the program is about, let's cover some of the information that you all had received when you went out and talked to veterans and veterans groups and everybody as this process was getting underway. What kinds of things did you happen to hear? And I'm sure they weren't all good about how the appeals process was going.
Well, I think the most we've heard was the length. It was just taking way too long, and it was very confusing. We at one point had a chart, and we actually called it the spaghetti chart.
Oh.
Because there was so much back and forth that you couldn't even tell where a case was, and veterans were just confused, and it was too complex.
So how does the new appeals process now compare to the old?
Well, the new process provides veterans three choices when they get their initial decision. If it's a denial or is not to their satisfaction, they can choose the higher level review lane. At the claims agency, they can choose the supplemental claims lane, which allows them to submit additional evidence at the claims agency, or they can come directly to the Board of Veterans' Appeals and file an appeal with us. What's important about this is, first and foremost, when they receive that initial decision, they're going to receive an approved notification letter, which clearly sets out in 8 points what's missing for them to proceed with their case. The other option, the other thing that's important is, depending on which lane they're in, which choice they make at the claims agency or the board, their timeline will be quicker. So if they go to the claims agency, we've committed to do those in approximately 125 days on average. If they come to the board and choose the direct review lane, we've committed to doing those on average in 365 days. That's much better than a 3 to 7 year wait.
Now, who is eligible to be able to take advantage of this new appeals process?
Well, veterans who currently have claims pending, if they receive a decision on or after February 19th of 2019, they'll automatically be into the appeals modernization process. Those veterans who are in the legacy process will have options, will have the opportunity to opt in to the appeals modernization, and that will occur when they receive decisions, and they should look very closely at the notices that they receive, because that will tell them how to go about doing so. They should also work very closely with their veteran service or advocate representative.
Mm-hmm. How long do you believe, if things go well, that should take for a veteran who has gone through the new process to get a decision?
Well, again, if they choose the claims agency lane, veterans are currently in our test program receiving decisions in approximately 125 days on average. The board lane, we're just starting to do those decisions in, and we expect those to take, on the direct review lane, about 365 days.
Mm-hmm. What is seems to be the reaction from your staff and other folks there in Washington and in the regions, for that matter, too, for the Department of Veterans Affairs to the process that's underway and finally is going to get officially ramped out here next week and trying to deal with the problems of veterans' appeals? How do they seem to feel about all the changes? I'm sure it's going to mean maybe for some extra work, maybe not. Maybe it will mean less work, I suppose.
Well, we've done a lot of changes in our technology and in our process and streamline. We've also hired some additional staff. So everybody's really looking forward to the opportunity. The staff at VA is really committed to making a difference to veterans and making sure that we provide those veterans opportunities and resolution. And we're focused on delivering results. In the field, what we've heard from our veteran service organizations and our advocates is that they're looking forward to seeing the process work. And they're excited for the changes.
I don't know if this would have any major changes with the medical centers and the like, in particular for us here, the Jesse Brown VA Medical Center in Chicago, which is we all, in our various outpatient clinics, feed into that area. Are they prepared for all of these changes that are going to be made? It might make it easier for them to handle some healthcare cases?
Absolutely. The board has worked very closely with Veterans Health Administration, which handles the Jesse Brown Medical Center, one of our great centers out there. And we are working very closely with them. They are part of the appeals processes. There are a few cases that come out of VHA, and they are getting training, and they are ready to go.
Mm-hmm. I was wondering if they have to, in talking with people, and they're either in the process of being treated for a case or being treated as a routine examination, if there's a possible problem that runs into, if they end up having to get back with you on the Board of Veterans Appeals to try to work these things out.
Yes, that's an option for mm-hmm. them. Again, this is about choice for the veterans, which choice is best for them to proceed with their case. So if they want to come to the board, that's an option, or they can go to the claims lanes. If they're not satisfied with the claims lane, they can still come to the board when they finish that lane.
Now, I guess the big question is, where can veterans go if they'd like to get some more information about modernizing the appeals process and in turn be able to take advantage of this, or if they have questions that they may have about the appeals process?
Well, veterans have many, many options. So first and foremost, we always suggest they talk to their veteran representative, and also they can check out www.va.gov.
That's Cheryl Mason, who is the head of the Board of Veterans Appeals with the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs. The NPR Planet Money team recently looked into the subject of plastic bags, of all kinds of plastic bags. And Morning Edition host Steve Inskeep gets us started.
Plastic bags, as you may know, have a bad reputation. They're not biodegradable. They're seen as a toxic pollutant that can do great harm to wildlife. Some states and hundreds of cities have now passed bans on plastic bags or are demanding a fee if you use one, but those bans may be having unintended consequences. NPR newsletter editor Greg Rosalsky joins Stacey Vanek Smith on our podcast, The Indicator, from NPR's Planet Money to explain.
Your newsletter, it was like a love letter to the plastic bag.
Yeah, a love letter might be a little much. I do love plastic bags, though. I do.
So tell us what you found.
So I talked to this economist. Her name's Rebecca Taylor. Taylor recently published this super interesting study about bag bans in California.
What I found was that sales of garbage bags actually skyrocketed after plastic carryout bags were banned.
So people had reuse their bags to, like, line trash bins.
Oh, I do that.
Do you use them to pick up dog poop? Because that's another common thing.
I don't
thing.
Have a dog.
I don't either. But all these people who reused their plastic bags, they still needed bags.
Small garbage bags, they went up by 120%. Their sales did. Medium bags went up by 60%.
And so here's the crucial thing that she told me. Garbage bags are actually thicker than shopping bags, so they use more plastic.
I find that about 30% of the plastic that was eliminated by banning carryout bags comes back in the form of thicker garbage bags.
But here's the thing. These bans didn't apply to paper bags.
Okay.
And that led to a huge increase of paper use.
I always get paper grocery bags.
Okay, Stacey, so please do not hate me for pointing this out.
Okay.
But so actually there are multiple studies. They all show that actually paper bags are worse for the environment than plastic.
Really?
Yeah, so paper bags have this one really great thing for them, which is they are biodegradable. They will eventually break down, but you have to use way more energy to create them. So we have a major uptick of trash bag sales, and then we have a major uptick of paper bag use. That's why Taylor says banning plastic shopping bags ends up increasing greenhouse gas emissions.
So I would say this leaves us with nothing, but there is a kind of bag that I use all the time. And, you know, this is public radio, so we cannot have this conversation without bringing up the Noble tote bag.
Stacey, no, I don't want to have to say this, but I have to. There's a study from the UK government, and they found a person would have to reuse a cotton tote bag 131 times before it was better for climate change than using a plastic grocery bag once.
Okay, Greg, but, like, we can't just carry things around in our arms. Like, what are we supposed to do?
You should reuse the same bag over and over again. Now, that bag should probably not be organic cotton. Use one that's, like, polyester or a somewhat durable plastic. But then there's kind of the broader policy question. Taylor thinks a fee is smarter than a ban. That's because they're both equally effective when it comes to the goal of encouraging reuse.
So about 50% of customers begin using reusable bags under both a ban and under a fee.
So impose a fee and encourage reuse.
Stacey Vanek Smith.
Greg Rosalsky, NPR News.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. It's time to check in on the finances here in Northwest Indiana in particular. And for that, of course, we turn to Northwest Indiana financial advisor Greg Hammer. And Greg, we're going to focus today on, the retirement proposals that Congress is offering. Tell us a little bit more about the SECURE Act and some of the common sense points that we need to know about this bill, since not all of us sit down and read the congressional record word for word or even look at it for that matter. How does this fit in with how we should be properly saving for our retirement?
Well, there's a couple of big things. It was the retirement bill that passed almost unanimously. It was a good bipartisan effort, but it's done a lot of the changes that people are familiar with. The main ones being they eliminated the restriction for making contributions to traditional IRAs. It used to be 70.5. At that point, if you were beyond that, even if you were still working, you could not make those contributions. Now they have lifted that restriction, so if somebody is still having earned income or possibly a spouse having earned income, they can continue to make those contributions as a qualified deduction into traditional IRAs even beyond the age 70.5. Also, they've done quite a bit with just the RMDs, the required minimum distributions. I think they made it a lot clearer. It used to be 70.5 that people had to take required minimum distributions. Now it's actually age 72, so we got rid of the half year, which is good. Potentially it would have been even, I think it would have helped out even a little bit more if they just reduced required minimum distributions altogether from smaller IRAs. But this will help out dramatically for the confusion a lot of times people have with that first year. And then probably the biggest thing that they feel is going to be a good revenue generator for them is they are eliminating the stretch IRA. So the big part of that when it comes to planning, you know, for clients and for individuals is they're no longer going to be able to have those multi-generational or stretch IRAs available for beneficiaries. It's going to restrict the funds to have to be completely withdrawn within the first 10 years.
Now, I suppose that this RMD change in the age from the 70 and a half, which sounds pretty confusing at best, and probably or even worst, to 72 is probably something that maybe even Congress could maybe take a better look at, maybe readjust in time?
Yeah, I mean, I think the big challenge is you know, everything's changing with people living longer. You know, so what used to be commonplace with the ages and, you know, forcing these distributions, so many people now, because of the concern of running out of money and just the longevity that exists now that didn't 20, 25, 30 years ago, you know, people are a little more apprehensive about retiring at 62. You know, they're looking to work beyond that or continue to work and continue to save. Just to make sure they're securing more of their retirement and concerns about, you know, assets and how long they'll last in retirement.
Now, I know that you mentioned the stretch IRA and gave us an idea about that. But is this going to be a real benefit for the average wage earner who is in turn saving money back for retirement? Or is this maybe something that Congress kind of thought was going to be a really big deal and may not turn out to be one after all?
Yeah, I think in their minds it was going to be something to help offset the cost of the other provisions changing where people would basically utilize assets sooner. But my opinion, the reality is most of the time people don't go beyond 10 years anyways with beneficiary IRAs. I think where more the changes will be, will individuals have to do a little bit different planning in terms of how strategic they are, utilize other vehicles, because if I was inheriting assets, I could stretch that out over my lifetime.
Yeah.
Now the fact that it has to be emptied within 10 years, you know, for larger qualified plans, people are probably going to look to address it in different ways.
Well, that'll be interesting to see what happens in that respect, too. Also, too, that I guess all of this together with in this bill that Congress has enacted is a $5,000 penalty-free clause for withdrawals. What is that all about, and then what kind of major impact are we likely to see on it?
I don't think it'll be a major impact, but specifically what it is, it allows new parents that are either adopting or having a child to access up to $5,000 from their qualified plan without any type of penalty. So while it sounds good, you know, Chris, you and I probably know that $5,000 is not going to have a huge impact either way, but it's just one more thing that is actually going to allow people to diminish the retirement savings. You know, one of the challenges is, you know, the more we borrow from our future, the less there usually is.
Mm-hmm.
But it does allow those new parents to have access in the case of a financial strain when it comes to either birth or adoption.
Well, as always, does it make sense to spend some time sitting down with your financial advisor when you have a chance to talk at length about some of these issues and this in particular? Because this is one of these things that comes out of Congress that you probably don't even think it needs to be reviewed, but probably have to sit down and explain a lot of things to people, I would imagine.
Well, absolutely. And I think some of the changes are pretty significant in terms of how you approach, you know, your planning aspect, specifically for those that are still working or planning to work beyond 70. But I think more importantly, for anybody that has potential assets that could be passed on to a child, they need to understand the changes in what this means with the elimination of the stretch IRA, not only for the child, but the potential tax implications that child could incur has dramatically changed how you might approach that planning process.
Well, probably after hearing this conversation, there'll be a lot of people getting to their Rolodexes or to the phone book and looking up the number for their financial advisors, making a reservation or an appointment to talk with somebody to get all these questions answered. And I guess we did our best to try to give you an idea of what this is all about. As always, Greg, thanks for spending some time with us talking about the SECURE Act and what kind of impact it might have on us here in Northwest Indiana.
No problem, Chris. Thanks for having me.
That's Northwest Indiana financial advisor, Greg Hammer. The Lake County Economic Alliance, or LCEA, is working with the City of East Chicago these days to bring in some proposals for companies to transform the abandoned West Calumet housing project site into some usable commercial or light industrial property. The LCEA's CEO, Karen Lauerman, was with us on Regionally Speaking to talk about this project and some of the others that the organization's taken on in the city of East Chicago recently. Have you kept pretty busy in that city over the last few years?
Yes, we have. In the North Sector, we've been seeing a greater amount of repurpose and reuse of the aged industrial facilities. But in this particular case, we have been looking at a lot of brownfield remediation across the North Sector. There are smaller brownfield parcels in other areas of the county, but we know that the brownfield remediation is critical to redevelopment and new opportunities. And part of that brownfield remediation has assisted us in having the governor and then the U.S. Department of Treasury identify certain parcels or census tracts for redevelopment through the Opportunity Zone program, which is a federal tax program under the current administration for investment of large scale.
Now, for those people who are not necessarily familiar with the term, what is the definition of brownfields?
Brownfield is a contaminated site, according to the EPA. It could be anything like a gas station that's been vacated. That could be considered a brownfield in certain respects. But we're looking at these larger industrial sites that had water, soil contamination, things of that nature.
Did you get involved with Mayor Anthony Copeland and the rest of the city of East Chicago, not only because of the past projects that you have worked on with the city of East Chicago, but in particular with the problems that he is dealing with there with what used to be the housing project that is on, unfortunately, lead-contaminated soil?
Right. We've been working with the mayor since I would say 2000, I can tell you exact date, September 22nd, 2014. That's the day that my partner, Don Kolobowski, and I started at LCEA. We were the first staff members of that organization. And one of the efforts was to engage each community and each municipal administration. And we went out and visited with Mayor Copeland and his team, and then started looking at the opportunities for reuse and repurpose of the aged industrial facilities, but not only that, where is there development opportunities? Part of our role and responsibility is to identify those buildings and the land space for end users, the companies that will create the jobs and put the investment in. And our job is to attract that private investment. So in looking at East Chicago, there's a very large piece of property on Kennedy Avenue that has been remediated to about 80% and will be remediated completely with the advent of some other development in that particular sector. And then with the neighborhood that you're mentioning, our job is to ask the question, what happens next? And if it's part of the mayor's plan, that's wonderful. That's the idea, to have a cohesive approach to development in any community and in throughout the county. With the West Calumet neighborhood, Zone 1 as we call it, what happens if the mayor's desire and the residents' desire goes off track? They want residential, and we respect that, and we work very closely with them on that opportunity. But what happens next? What happens if that doesn't come to fruition? Mm-hmm. We have to have a backup plan. And part of our thought process was to take all of the interest we were receiving because of the Opportunity Zone designation. That, again, that's that federal tax break program for the investment programs. Take those areas and take a look at what can be done. And we've got a lot of interest from those developers. So the prudent thing to do is say, hey, what would you guys propose on that site? If you've got an idea, share it with us. And we'll be happy to then share it with the mayor and his team. But we're not the decision makers. We're simply carrying a conceptual message, an option, so to speak, to the city. And if something is of interest to them and they'd like to pursue and proceed, we'll help them through that process. And if not, then they're going to go about making that residential opportunity come to pass.
So what you are working with, putting it out, I guess, from the city of East Chicago standpoint, is not really a request for proposals, although it's kind of like that. Mm-hmm. You're just trying to get an idea from what companies are out there, non-profit businesses and the like, corporations and the like, that might be interested in and maybe specialize in this type of work to take this particular area, in particular with the West Calumet Housing District area, and find some useful uses for it, I guess,
right,
at some point after the contamination gets cleaned up.
Correct. And what we're looking for are developers that can do both. And, you know, in the long run, the idea is, regardless of whatever status it becomes, what is the ultimate reuse? This thought process and RFP, you know, we wanted to make sure they were qualified developers. And these developers have experience in both remediation and actual business park or logistics or light manufacturing developments. These are the types of industry clusters that we want to attract to those sites, because there's no advantage to putting any sort of heavy industrial. You know, we're not going to put a chemical blender on that particular piece of property.
Right.
That's not resuited. You're not going to put a type of company that just came off of that site back into use on that site. The idea is to remediate, improve, and enhance.
I understand that you have several, three or four companies that have had offered up some ideas.
Mm-hmm.
We know that there are certain things, non-disclosure agreements and things like that, that you have to abide by to get them to participate.
Right.
Are these can you generally say that these companies, maybe they're based on the East Coast or maybe here in the Midwest or elsewhere, since they have this experience that you're looking for, mm-hmm, in not only remediation of the problem soil in this case, but also developing the site once it's cleaned up?
Yes. The four companies that we've been working with have national and international experience in this.
Mm-hmm.
The majority of them have, in fact, all of them, have development arms and environmental arms. It's environmental arm that will be able to do the remediation work, and the development arm that has the contacts and the relationships with companies that want to locate close to the Illinois border.
Coming up here on June 1st at the Bricky Bowl, the historic Bricky Bowl, I guess we should say, because actually, if for anybody that doesn't know, the Bricky Bowl was built back in the 1930s. It was a WPA project. So that puts it in in the Depression era, more than World War II era, I suppose. But that's how the Bricky Bowl got started. Of course, it's the scene of been many, many, many high school football games over the years with the Hobart Brickies. And now it's going to have another life, I suppose, in a way, as being what is hopefully going to be a continuing venue for the Hometown Country Jam Country Music Festival. And we have with us the fellow who has created everything. Well, not the Bricky Bowl. It was already
not
there.
The Bricky Bowl. That's way before me.
But the Hometown Country Jam is his idea. Tyrus Josephorski. Has created Flight Levels Entertainment. You had to basically create your own business, I suppose, to be able to get this thing off the ground?
Yeah, essentially. And there's some meaning behind that name,
okay,
too.
Okay, well, tell us about that.
Well, actually, so by trade, I'm actually an airline pilot.
Mm-hmm.
So Flight Levels, that kind of where
that
all that
sense.
Came from.
Yeah.
And that's actually where the idea came from for the Hometown Country Jam. I was flying along with a captain one night, 35,000 feet, and he actually used to be a country touring artist. And the light bulb just went off, and I was like, country music festival, that would fit in perfect here. So that's kind of where it all started, and that was probably back last June now, so year from when the event will be.
What got you into thinking that a good venue would be the Bricky Bowl?
Well, there's a few things. One, obviously, the historicness behind it. It appeals to a lot of people, this bringing life back to it. People are excited about that. You know, there hasn't been anything really done there in almost 10 years, and the city put almost $1 million into it. So they renovated all the bleachers. So there's that aspect, just the hype behind that. And then location itself. Within Northwest Indiana, we have almost 1 million people here. And Hobart's so centrally located that it's a 20-minute drive from everyone. So I saw a lot of value in that. So that's one of the reasons, multiple reasons, we want to do it at the Bricky Bowl.
And obviously, besides the opportunity to take advantage of a ready-made venue, because you have lots and lots of bleacher space and lots and lots of space on the ground for not only the stages, but for spectators as well, too.
Absolutely.
How much help would you say the city of Hobart has offered up here, besides the actual work on the structure itself, which they've done with money they've had available over the years?
Yeah, nothing but amazing things to say about them. Mayor Snedeker and events director Nikki Lopez, HPD, they've all been fantastic. So essentially, when I came to originally Councilman Josh Huddleston with this idea, he was like, absolutely, I need to get you in contact with the mayor. So we all sat down and talked about this. I kind of laid them out a plan, and they're like, let's do this. You know, they put all the money into the Bricky Bowl. A A lot of people want to see life come back to the Bricky Bowl, and they've been amazing when it comes to permitting, et cetera. I mean, they're handling kind of all that behind the scenes, like state politics stuff. It's a huge relief off my shoulders, and they really just want to see Hobart grow, and they want to see, you know, these kinds of acts and entertainment value coming into the city. So they've been fantastic.
Well, let's talk about the entertainment that's going to be coming up here for the Country Music Festival itself on June 1st. And I guess there are some stories, at least one in particular, that we should look into here involving one of the performing acts, or I should say a gentleman who is representing a performing act in his own right, we understand. Montgomery Gentry is one of the highline performers for the show that night. Tell us about Montgomery Gentry, which is actually the name of a group, but it's now become one sole performer. Tell us about him.
Well, I'd actually say it's still a group. That band itself has stuck together for many, many years, and they've been stuck together since, you know, the death of Troy Gentry. And they're an amazing group, of guys. And, you know, they've been around for 20-plus years. They've had 5 number one hits, 10 top 10 singles. So they've been around the block, and everyone knows the name. And that's one of the reasons I wanted to bring them in. And I went and actually saw them in Shipshewana a couple months back, and man, they rock.
Really?
You know, they're fantastic. So essentially what they do now is Eddie Montgomery, the surviving member of the duo, he still sings his normal parts, and the rest of the band then picks up Troy's parts. And they sound fantastic. So they're really, really doing, you know, amazing for Troy's memory. And I think people are going to be really excited to see him.
Devin Dawson is one of the other performers who's involved in country music, of course, in Nashville. Tell us about him, what he's done, and what he's going to bring to the event.
Yeah, Devin, he took off here really last year. He had a major year. He had a hit single, All On Me. It's at over 100 million streams on Spotify alone. That's not counting iTunes or anything else. He actually got his fame from a Taylor Swift cover he did. And Taylor Swift just retweeted it, and people blew up. You know, they loved it, and they loved him. And then he came out with his hit album, Dark Horse, which is the song Dark Horse is what's on the radio now that people would recognize. But he's awesome. He's kind of, they call him the country music dark horse, you know. He's kind of like a gothic. He wears all black when he performs. All his Instagram posts are in black and white. It's a really cool vibe that he puts off, and he's put a country twist to it all, and it's really fun.
Do you think he's going to be the next man in black?
I think
he's vying for that honor?
I think he has a very, very good opportunity to continue to take off in country music and be a major player in the years to come. Okay.
One of the other performers coming up for the Hometown Country Jam Country Music Festival that's going to be held in Hobart at the Bricky Bowl on June 1st is an artist who is known by only one name.
Fillmore, yes. So he was Tyler Fillmore, and then they took the first name off of it, and he became just Fillmore. He's another amazing up-and-comer. He gained his fame on Spotify as well, millions of listeners and followers every month. He's kind of more of a poppy country artist. So when I built this lineup, I wanted to hit every type of country you could think of. Montgomery Gentry, the old legacy act who everyone knows, everyone loves, you know, hit songs. Devin Dawson, he's his own style of country music. Fillmore is the poppy country artist. Because I wanted to appeal to everyone. And Fillmore, he really appeals to the younger urban crowd, and he puts on an awesome show, man. He is fantastic.
Now, does it seem that the next performer that's on the bill, Noah Guthrie, is he more like what we consider, if not a traditional country singer, maybe an old school country singer?
He's kind of got a really raspy voice, and it just sounds amazing. He was on America's Got Talent, and he placed second, I believe it was last year. And he really took off on social media, and people really, really appealed to him. He actually, originally we had an artist, Abby Anderson, on the bill, but she got put on a major tour, so unfortunately we had to sacrifice our rights for her to perform, as she was going to be on a major tour this summer, and we wish her nothing but the best. So I kind of wanted to have that female aspect to the festival. So when we lost her, you know, it was kind of a bummer, but Noah Guthrie is nobody to sleep on. He's amazing.
That's great. There is a reason that we have all these big name acts, up-and-comers and the like, that are performing. Opening the show on June 1st is going to be a local person, and that's as intended. Tell us how the idea of having somebody from Northwest Indiana, number one, on the show is planned, and there's a reason behind it, I'm sure.
Absolutely. So local is big to me. You know, I grew up here. This is my area. And we want to give the local artist a chance to grow and be seen. So our local artist, Jay Wakasey, union steel worker, I was like, man, that's perfect. Mm-hmm. You know, that fits in perfect to the region, to the hometown. And that's what we called it, you know, the Hometown Country Jam, because this really, I want everyone to be proud of it. I want them to feel passionate about it. And this is their hometown. So.
All right, let's get to some of the basic info that everybody should know if they're interested in going to the Hometown Country Jam coming up on June 1st at the Bricky Bowl in Hobart. Number one, when's the festival start and end?
So it's on June 1st. Doors open at 3 p.m., and then there are closed curfews at 11 p.m., so it's all day. Mm-hmm. We have almost 20 food vendors who are going to be there, everything from Puerto Rican food to pierogies to barbecue. And I think people really like that, is these summer markets and stuff are just taking off. So we wanted to bring that appeal to it. Once again, it just appeals to that hometown feel. It's all ages event. So we have the kids zone, you know, inflatables, bounce houses, obstacle courses. And then everything's going to be broken down. So we have the bleachers. We have a lawn area where people can bring their blankets and chairs.
Yeah,
and
I was
just
going
lay
to ask
out on the
about,
bowl.
About that to find out, because, you know, kind of like a la Ravinia, the people that are always wanting to be out there, or they're assigned out there, or they pay for the lawn seats out there, or just places on the lawn where they can stretch out and bring their snacks and sit there and
just
enjoy
hang
themselves.
Out, man. And then we're going to have standing room only for GA, and then we have our VIP pit, which is a standing room stage front pit for our VIP attendees. So
now, for people that are interested, we've been talking about the acts and talking about the other things that are important for a music festival, like food.
Absolutely.
For sure. To be sure, how about the ticket situation? Where can people get tickets and so things that they need to know here before the event on June 1st?
So our tickets are broken into separate tiers. We have tier 1, 2, and 3. Tier 1 is already sold out. We sold out our VIP and our GA Tier 1 tickets. So right now, Tier 2 is on sale. And you can get those at hometowncountryjam.com. And it's real easy. Eventbrite, we went with Eventbrite because it's low processing fees. Mm-hmm. You know, unlike Ticketmaster, you got to pay $10 extra on top of the ticket. It's only like $2 or $3 for their processing fee. So we're like, we wanted to go for them. And really, we wanted to keep the prices low. You know, you go to these major festivals in Chicago, and it's over $100, you know, and it's, you're spending almost, you know, half your paycheck if you want to take your family to a concert. So we wanted to bring the Chicago feel here, you know, with the big stage, the big acts, for half the price. So that was our goal.
No one probably... Not only the entertainment value, but probably one of the most important things to note is that there's going to be a Northwest Indiana nonprofit that's going to help benefit from the proceeds.
Tell us
about that.
Exciting
and
part.
How did you get them involved in this?
Funny story. My girlfriend, actually, she loves animals, and she goes, you know, what if you got the Humane Society involved? And I was like, that's perfect. So I reached out to the Humane Society of Hobart, and they're completely on board. They're going to be on site. I think they have some awesome things planned. They're not going to be able to have the dogs on site and cats, unfortunately, but they're going to have, you know, the flyers and possibly some on-site adoptions, maybe some discounts if you want to adopt on site. Those logistics are still being worked out, but we're really excited to have them involved. They're going to get a percentage of all the proceeds. I really wanted to have that charity aspect involved with the festival.
Well, it's nice to know that the Humane Society of Hobart is very much, not only they'll appreciate getting a share of the proceeds, but also that they're very much involved with the project. Since this is the inaugural event, I'm making the assumption that you're planning for more of these after this one this summer.
That is the plan. I would love to expand on not only this festival, but the opportunity to bring other acts to Hobart, Indiana, to Northwest Indiana, whether if it's a rock event or, you know, a pop event. And has we really have the opportunity to just grow from here. So definitely want to continue with the Hometown Country Jam in the years to come and watch out for other concerts to come as well.
That's great. Well, Tyrus, thank you for spending time with us today to talk about the event coming up. Tyrus Josephorski is the organizer of the Hometown Country Jam. It's a country music festival. It's going to be held on June 1st, which is a Saturday, by the way, and it'll be held at the historic Bricky Bowl in Hobart, Indiana. And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for joining us. Tomorrow we have for you some of the conversations with Northwest Indiana's legislative members from the General Assembly session of 2019. We hope you'll join us.